Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullen.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullen, and this is a show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. So coming up on today's show, inflation. A new book from one of the world's leading economic minds argues that it's just something we'll always have to live with. The economics of being a carer. We talk to carers about the true cost of minding people and big tobacco's fight to make money. You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on LinkedIn, Instagram, X and Blue Sky at Susan Hayes Cullen. Now, I want to start off this week by explaining what the word real means to economists. Now, you might be wondering, why am I picking up on a term that's so everyday? But real means inflation adjusted. When it comes to your pension or your savings or the value of your house or the value of anything that you own, all that really matters is what you'll be able to buy with the money you make from selling it. So when it comes to planning for the future, what matters is the real or inflation-adjusted value of your money.
Okay, so with cigarette smoking now accepted in fewer places than ever, what are tobacco companies doing to ensure their revenues and their profits, and what sort of externalities spring from that? So I'm delighted to be joined by Clara Murray from the Financial Times, who's joining me now to talk about some economic and social trends arising from this. So Clara, first of all, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first up, let's just get a sense of this market at the moment. So tobacco use has halved since 2000. In the US, sales of regulated, and I say that intentionally because we need to talk about unregulated, but sales of regulated vaping devices has fallen every month for the past 2 years. And British American Tobacco wants to be predominantly smokeless by 2035. What's driving these developments?
Yeah, so basically the sort of major tobacco companies have realized that due to basically a combination of social trends, people are seeing smoking and as less healthy, less obviously people are well aware of the negative health impacts of smoking. And meanwhile, governments are cracking down on cigarettes more and more, whether that's through taxes, like, and you know, things like smoke-free generations, marketing bans, and so on. So the tobacco companies kind of know this is coming in the future, even though they all still make the majority of their profits from cigarettes around the world. They're all very eager to look at other revenue streams. And so they're all investing in things like e-cigarettes, which is vaping, heated tobacco, and recently nicotine pouches. So that's what they're sort of starting to drive their revenue growth from.
And I want to get into all of those one by one, Clara. But so it still is the case that despite the fact that cigarette smoking has halved since 2000, that that's still a very significant source of profits for the tobacco companies.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the tobacco company that has, you know, moved the most over to revenue from other sources, so what they call reduced risk products, is Philip Morris. And they're only at around 40% of their revenue from these products. So the other major company, and it's all 80% or more, is still coming from the sort of bread and butter cigarettes.
Bread and butter cigarettes. So can I just get into the vapes then, right? Let's just look at that one, because they were supposed to be the product that was going to save the industry. And of course, they were deemed to be a real alternative to the cigarette, both in terms of the actual experience of inhaling and blowing out again. But e-cigarettes use has fallen to the lowest level in a decade. So are vapes on the way out?
Yeah, I mean, they're still really popular. I think if you look at the stats, it's still a really high amount of people, especially young people, are still vaping. So in the UK, I think it's around a third of young adults, or 1 in 10 adults generally. And actually, in a lot of countries, more people are vaping than smoking. So it's still like a really, really big market. But what we are starting to see is the sort of explosive kind of growth that happened maybe at the start of this decade, when really cheap disposable vapes came in, and the growth is kind of leveling off and in some cases starting to decline. And I think the stat you're referring to is in the US, like high school students are actually starting to desert it, which maybe is a sign that it's becoming less cool. It's less of the done thing these days. So I think the tobacco companies are starting to realize that the idea that everyone was just going to seamlessly switch from smoking over to vaping wasn't true. And it maybe doesn't have quite the consumer appeal that it once did. And so they're now starting to look to other things.
Is part of the consumer appeal being cool? Like when I talk to my mother-in-law about when she used to smoke, like it was what the celebrities did. Is vaping still cool?
I feel like I'm not the most qualified person to ruin on that, but I think we are, you know, it hasn't quite reached the same sort of level of like cultural dominance as smoking. Like if you think about, you know, you don't see Tom Cruise, for example, like vaping. There's none of these like younger celebrities are really taking up to the same extent. So that could be part of it. And it could also just be that things like nicotine pouches are coming in and they're just appealing a little bit more to younger people. Maybe it's because they're being marketed more effectively to them, or because they kind of are a bit more health conscious and they don't want to be inhaling anything. Because vaping is obviously considered to be healthier than cigarettes, but you are still taking vapor into your lungs. So it's not completely without health drawbacks.
And that's why I want to ask you about the regulated nature of it. Like, as you say, you're inhaling something into your lungs. Obviously, there's been an awful lot of warnings on cigarette packages and the health, I was going to say benefits, but obviously it's the opposite. The health risks posed by that have been very well documented and articulated. But in a piece that you wrote, I just found it interesting. You know the phrase, the US innovates while the EU regulates. How has the US gotten to the point where unregulated products make up 8 billion of the 10 billion market in vaping?
Yeah. It's like a really, really huge market, the unregulated. And I mean, unregulated basically include anything that hasn't been officially signed off by the FDA, by the regulator, but they can still be legally sold in the meantime while they're making a decision. And the decisions can take quite a long time to come through. And so there's been this huge growth in brands, largely like Chinese brands being imported, and the likes of like Elf Bar, Lost Mary, and so on. And they're just not kind of officially approved. And they're really, really popular. I mean, they come in like every single color of the rainbow, every flavor you can imagine. And some of them even have, you know, things like LED lights and like little screens attached into them. So they're really quite like fun and engaging products. And I think they're products that the major tobacco companies would sort of shy away from because they do sort of get the PR backlash over potentially appealing to teenagers, whereas some of the Chinese brands maybe seem to care a little bit less about that. And
Clara, everything we've talked about today is something you hold in your hand, like a cigarette or a vape is in your hand. But these new nicotine pouches are a whole other ballgame, because you insert them in between your gum and your lip, basically. And they're the fastest growing new nicotine category. The gross margin of these are 75%, while cigarettes are 60%. What's the word in the street about these new products? Or are they new?
Yeah, they are quite new. They've actually developed out of an older product called snus, which is really popular in Scandinavia, especially Sweden. And that's it's sort of like a little tea bag almost that contains tobacco leaf that you, as you said, put under your lip and it gets absorbed into your bloodstream. So about 10 years ago, they developed a version of this where basically you take out the tobacco leaf, just leave the nicotine, maybe some fillers, some flavoring, but you use it in exactly the same way. And this has kind of been a bit of a slow burn for most of the past decade. It was growing in popularity in the US, but in the past 2 years, it's just really, really exploded. I think partially because the tobacco companies are starting to market it quite heavily, but also because in the US there's been this huge kind of cultural phenomenon almost. A lot of like online conversations a lot of like young male influencers have really gotten behind this one brand called Bin, and like the increase in popularity of Zyn has been kind of incredible. And they're expecting to sell more than 800 million cans of it this year, which from a product that didn't even exist a decade ago, I think is kind of amazing.
And if we take a trip around the world, like you mentioned Sweden there and you mentioned the US. So they're banned in Belgium and France and the Netherlands. They're available on prescription. I'm not sure what you'd need now for these on prescription. But anyway, in Australia and New Zealand, they've overtaken vapes in the US. And in Sweden, where you've mentioned where it sounds like it began, they're three times more popular than smoking. What do you think the future holds here? Like, you've spoken about the growth over the past decade. What does the next couple of years hold? Further rise and rise? Or more banned?
It's kind of hard to say exactly because, yeah, as you say, governments are starting to kind of regulate them quite strictly. And in a lot of cases, it concerns over their appeal to young people, which they do seem to be quite appealing to young people. But usage is still quite low comparatively. I think in the UK, it's around 2% of adults use them at the minute. So, you know, quite good for like a new product, but it's still relatively low. And like I said, there's a lot of marketing that's going into them. I think pretty much every major festival in the UK at the minute is being sponsored by one of these nicotine pouch brands. They're handing out free samples. They're really trying to get it off the ground. At the minute in the UK, it's completely unregulated. So you could theoretically sell these to an 8-year-old. They can come in any flavor, any strength. So this is the sort of thing that making regulators sort of take notice. The EU is bringing in new regulations. We're not sure exactly what yet. It's probably not going to be a complete ban, but they think they're going to start cracking down on how these are being branded, what sort of flavors are going into them, that sort of thing. And the UK is probably going to follow suit. So it kind of, it's an open question how far the regulators are going to go and whether they really want to dump this out, whether they kind of are thinking we don't want any more people being addicted to nicotine, or whether they take the sort of more measured view that, you know, actually these pouches, and we're not entirely sure what the long-term harms are, but we do know that they're probably a lot better than cigarettes. So we should keep them quite freely available.
Clara, you know, the way you said they're of any strength, how strong could these nicotine patches be relative to a cigarette?
Yeah, so relative to a cigarette, I mean the pouches actually come in different strengths, which is another thing that sort of sets them apart from cigarette a little bit. So you can choose whether you want to have like a light one or a regular or a strong one. So the regular ones would be around 6 to 10 milligrams of nicotine, which is about the same as a cigarette. But the difference with the cigarette is because a lot of it burns off as you smoke it. So you're not actually absorbing all of that. So they think it's maybe around 3 to 4 times as strong in terms of the nicotine content. And then because they're not regulated, theoretically, you can put as much nicotine in these as you want. A super strength one, it can be like 50 milligrams of nicotine, which is obviously much, much more than you would get in a cigarette. And then there are some from, I guess, kind of smaller brands that are advertised as being, you know, 200. So yeah, they can really pack quite a lot of nicotine in one go.
And I learned a new phrase when I was reading some of your pieces about this. Socially contagious. Clara, I thought, this is such a great term. So to explain what listeners are, what that means is that, like, you can see somebody smoke and vape, but you can't see someone if they have one of these things shoved up into their mouth. So you describe these pouches as less socially contagious. Is that a good thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a good thing if you're concerned about more people getting addicted to nicotine. The sort of idea is that part of the fun, apparently, from smoking cigarettes is, you know, going outside, maybe sharing a lighter, maybe rolling the cigarette. Similarly for vaping, there's a bit more of a, yeah, socially contagious aspect to it, where you see other people doing it and you think, oh, I want to try that. Whereas the pouches, they're quite discreet. There's an aspect of them that I personally think is a little bit gross. Like, you kind of have to take them out of your mouth and they're really covered in spit. And
you're selling them well here.
Exactly, which you don't get with a vape. But then some of the people I interviewed, some of the users for the story were kind of saying that actually, you know, they use them in work, they share them with their coworkers, and they do feel like it is a bit of a social thing, and they do use them in much the same way as cigarettes. So it could be that culture is just kind of going to move on and adapt, and people will start forming habits around them.
Well, I hope when they said they were sharing them with co-workers now that it was, you know, there was a bit of context to that. But anyway, we won't go there. Clara Murray from the Financial Times, thanks so much indeed for joining me and for talking about all sorts of trends when it comes to the tobacco industry. Really appreciate your time today.
Thanks so much.
This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we look at the economics of being a carer. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton. Now, from limited support to mounting costs, we're going to explore the real impact that challenges have on carers and the urgent need for change. And I'm joined by Majella Beattie from Care Champions, as well as Jamie Williams, co-founder and chair of the Phoenix Rising Network and mother to two children with additional needs, to discuss the daily financial struggles faced by family carers across Ireland. Now, I want to talk about this as it's a subject that's close to my heart. My mum cared for my granny, my granduncle, and who I called my third granny next door to us. My brother-in-law is currently caring for my mother-in-law. My cousin is caring for my godmother at the moment. I'm sure, like many of you listening today, who are either caring for somebody yourself or like me, you can list several people close to you who are. It's such an important topic, and it's very, very important that we give a voice to people who are doing this day in, day out. So first of all, Majella and Jamie, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Now, Jamie, can I start with you? I'm going to start off with some of the numbers. So over 1 in 8 people provide care to family members. And in the last recorded census in 2022, the number of people doing so increased by 50%. There are 4,759 carers under the age of 15 in the country, and 7% of the population in Leitrim, Sligo, Mayo and Galway are carers, and 57% of carers over 15 are also in employment. Can you tell us what life is like for carers in Ireland today?
I can, and I can give you some figures that might paint a clearer picture for that, because luckily for us, Family Carers Ireland put together a State of Caring survey in 2024, where they did a bit of research on the subject. So I have some of those figures with me. 69% of carers struggle to make ends meet, they found, with 29% cutting back on essentials like food and heat, with 16% unable to pay the rising cost of utility bills. And that would have only gotten worse as the cost of living crisis has toppled upon us. 49% pay privately for essential supports like medical equipment, home adaptations, and respite care. Others just do without because they really just can't afford it. Means testing excludes many carers from the payment itself, and the payment fails to cover the basic needs. So you have people, the majority being women, who are essentially at the mercy of whomever they're cohabiting with. And not a thought is being given to the possibility of financial abuse towards the critical cohort we have here, who save the state at least $20 billion per annum. And the housing crisis is really a multiplier for this. The housing adaptation grant hasn't increased in a decade. While costs have only risen, obviously, carers are going into debt for essential modifications that provide their loved ones a bit of independence or even a modicum of positive quality of life.
Jamie, I want to come back to you on a range of those figures because they tie in with a couple of things that I have found in my own research. And just before I do that, though, Majella, if I just quote the first number there that Jamie said, 69% of people struggle to make ends meet. I was looking into who is in receipt of carers allowance. And while the census says 300,000 people in 2022 were caregivers, yet only 99,000 individuals are receiving carers allowance. So is it the case actually that there could be a lot of people listening to us today who could be availing of supports available and simply aren't aware of them?
I think that many people are aware of carers allowance, but it's a really, really difficult process. The application process is really difficult. It puts such a strain on carers. The appeal process is really, really challenging. The means testing limit is quite low. And, you know, I suppose if you put it into context, the people who are receiving or are looking to are in receipt of carers allowance are people who oftentimes have given up their job. They still have all these additional costs and they really are left in a situation out of love. Because they love the person that they're caring for, they are now living below the poverty line. So I know in my own case, I had to, unfortunately, my parents are now deceased. I had to give up work to look after my parents. And I literally went from having a wage to taking months fighting for a carer's allowance and not being able to even have the money in my pocket to pay somebody to come in to sit with one parent if I was in hospital with the other. So while there are, on paper, it looks like we have all these additional supports, but many of them are actually out of the reach of carers when they find themselves in the situation of caring.
Okay. And I want to delve into that as well. Before I do, Jamie, can I go back to the 20 billion euro figure that you quoted? Because I know where that comes from. And that where that comes from is that it is estimated that carers provide 1 billion hours. That's 1 billion, would it be? 1 billion hours of care in the country. And if everybody was paid 20 euro per hour, that's where that 20 billion comes from. And it's a huge, huge number. And I want to compare that with what is actually spent, because the National Service Plan in 2024 targeted funding at an expected 22 million with an M, home support hours for 54,000 people and 23,280 people in residential care. So therefore, our economy isn't necessarily representative of what's really happening on the ground. So what do you want to see change then, Jamie, both in terms of the financial recognition, but also the broader societal support for this?
Well, I would say my top three things that I would want to see changed are the abolishment of the means testing for carers allowance and an increase to the payments to give carers and people with disabilities a living wage, I would say, for both. That's absolutely critical. We also need to boost the housing adaptation grants and the respite funding because they're not even covering the cost of the adaptations, and respite is nil. There is no respite to be seen. And also, public bodies really need to be collecting care-specific data to monitor policy impact. That is absolutely critical. This isn't something that should be only solely supplied by voluntary organizations. This is something that the state should be focusing on. Because I'll tell you what, though, that $20 billion per annum and the calculation of the carers is not adequate. We don't have proper data, and that's the problem. Because Family Carers Ireland, I think, has 500,000 people signed up as a member. And I think that's where that data may have come from. But that's just the member sign-up. That's not the case of, you know, how many carers are out there. Mm-hmm. It really isn't, you know, because not everybody is going to sign up to a voluntary organization. They're just, they're not going to have the time to even look it up, especially with caring duties the way that they are. So I do feel that those are probably the most critical things that we need to be looking at, because carers really aren't looking. They're not asking for sympathy. They're demanding that Ireland close these loopholes that permit systemic discrimination and systemic violence, because that's what it comes down to. Poverty really isn't a personal failure. It's the result of a state failing to value care work. And protecting carers in law isn't charity. It's justice for those holding up our crumbling care system. And we really deserve better. And so do the people we care for.
Well, Majella, I want to look at each of the three points there that Jamie made, right? First point is the abolishment of the means payment. The government says that would cost the state $3 billion, and there's, I won't go into how that's calculated. It's from a range of different points. The second point that that Jamie talks about there is the housing adaptation grant. So that is a grant that's available. It's a maximum of €40,000. There's the Mobility Aids Grant Scheme for a maximum of €8,000. There's the Housing Aid for Older Persons. And of course, I do want to make sure that listeners are aware, I'm not just talking about the elderly here. Of course, there also will be children and older adults as well who are suffering from a disability. And that's something we've talked about on the show as well. But can you talk us through, how do people get access to these, first of all? And secondly, how accessible are they really?
Okay, so I agree that we need to seriously look at the carers allowance and either getting rid of it or serious reform. And we most certainly need to come up to a living wage. During COVID, we saw the COVID payment, €350, and that was considered the living wage then. And then, of course, the cost of living has dramatically increased in that time. So without a doubt, that is something that urgently needs to be addressed. In its absence, we are continuing to allow people to suffer under enormous financial, emotional and exhaustion, and in an isolation situation, which in turn is costing the system an awful lot more, because we are finding that carers, and many of our carers are themselves older people, they may be caring for a wife or somebody, and our community care systems are so broken, there's very little support. And the end result of that is when a carer, oftentimes you're caring for an older person or that person passes, you will find carer burnout, and you will find that there is an enormous amount of carers who end up in the medical system because of the impact on their own health. They may not have looked after themselves or had the time to look after themselves when their person that they were caring for was here. You also find that many of the people that we care for, we end up with no alternative because we can't get basic supports in the community. But to push people into long-term residential care, whether or not they want to go or whether or not we want them to go. So while the state is talking about that we would use an enormous amount of money in trying to fix one part of the system, we need to look at this holistically. We need to look at the family care, the impact of care and the supports that are around that person. And then you need to look at the outcomes as they are now when we're not addressing these issues. Like, without a doubt, family care is safe, an estimated $20 billion. I would expect it as an awful lot more than that.
Well, I think there's also the number that you need to look at there, which is what you said, Majella, in your own case, where people are leaving their own job and you've got the opportunity cost of the wages there. But I also know from personal experience, as I mentioned at the beginning of this interview, that I know that the carer as well constantly is thinking about or worrying about the person that they're caring for. They're constantly waiting for the phone to ring. They don't really sleep. And then, of course, there's all of the things that can happen, like unexpected developments or queues at hospitals and all that goes with it. And that's why I think it's so important that we certainly do talk about this. Jamie, can I go to the balancing work with caring as well? 1 in 9 in the workforce is juggling a caring role. And almost half of family carers live in households with less than €30,000 of an annual income. And right now, employees who are caring for relatives have a legal right to request flexible working arrangements and up to 5 days of unpaid carers leave. What are the challenges, or what is the unspoken elements that we need to hear about people who are trying to balance paid work with caring responsibilities?
Okay, so I just want to say that I really agree with statements from earlier. Carers are providing the state should be currently at a cost to their own finances, their own mental health, their own physical health. And care poverty is directly compromising care quality. And the financial strain is forcing cuts to therapeutic services or nutrition for carers and care recipients, because they're cutting down on their food shopping. They're cutting down on things like that, even when they're working, because of the additional cost and the additional needs. And housing inadequacies on top of that increase all risks and hospitalizations, putting pressure on an already overcrowded and failing health system. So then carers they're stuck in a loop where they're unable to work due to the support gaps, due to the lack of respite. But they maybe they're working and they find somebody to cover, but there's a reduced income no matter what due to the additional needs, because of the means testing, because you have to watch every hour you're working, you have to watch how much you're making. So even if you're a very qualified person, and maybe you can do things that maybe the average carer can't, you end up stuck in this loop with poorer care outcomes as a result. Because the additional needs stack up so high, you can never get your head above water. And it's gotten to the point now where it's really critical, because at least 35% of renters and 17% of mortgage holders, this is in 2024, they would have missed payments in their 2023-2024 period for their mortgage or their rent. And these figures would have only increased with the cost of living crisis as it's worsening, putting both carers and disabled people at risk of homelessness during a housing crisis. So what this comes down to is it's really a breach of human rights via institutional neglect. And it's also worth noting that we will be facing a UNCRPD audit soon enough. And at this rate, we will be failing miserably as a state. And we really can do better for carers. It really is a choice.
Well, I want to thank you both, not just for coming on the show today to talk about this topic, but just for the work you do. And I just hope that you know that while the economics may not be able to count the phenomenal depth and breadth of the work that you and the carers right across the country do, this show certainly can. So thank you both, Majella Beatty of Care Champions, and also to Jamie Williams, co-founder and chair of the Phoenix Rising Network and a mother to 2 children with additional needs. Thanks so much on behalf of the country. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, money's dirtiest secret, inflation. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton. Well, who remembers the economic picture before 2020? Inflation was at record low levels throughout the world, and then COVID arrived and there was a real danger of double-digit inflation running. So is it too simple to explain the resurgence of inflation and the pandemic? Or were there other factors involved? Now, my next guest's book explores this. As the chief economist of the Danish Central Bank, he knows the dangers of high inflation. Thomas Haar, author of The Great Inflation Resurgence, Why Inflation Returned in the 2020s and What to Expect Next. You're very welcome to Taking Stock today, Thomas.
Thank you. And thanks a lot for having me on the show, Susan.
Well, I was inspired to read your book, actually, after it has made it on the list of the CFA Society Ireland Book Club. And One of the things that I think the book does really well, Thomas, is how well it shows how differently the composition of inflation is made up in different places around the world. So, for example, 35% of the CPI, which is an index of how we measure inflation, in the US is made up of shelter. In China, pork is an important part of the national diet and thus the CPI. Onions and tomatoes in India and chili prices in Indonesia. So can you, first of all, critique society's understanding of what inflation is for a start?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Susan. And you're exactly right. That are some of the things we are trying to talk a lot about in the book. So you can say inflation is basically the change in consumer prices compared to a year ago. So that's the important thing to remember. It's a change in prices. So if you just have high prices, that is not the same as inflation. It's a change compared to a year ago. And then you basically create what you call a basket, which is supposed to reflect what an average person in a given country, what that person is consuming. And that is where there is a lot of differences between countries, because as you mentioned, for example, porks in China, porks is something the Chinese people consume a lot. So that is a significant part of how you measure inflation in China. Whereas in other countries, porks will not matter a lot. And other things like housing, for example, in the US matters a lot in terms of how you measure inflation. For example, in the US, for some, you can say more or less technical reason, housing is a more important part of how you measure inflation than it is, for example, in Europe. And that is not only because housing is more important for the US consumer, it's simply also in terms of how you measure inflation. So there is a lot of differences between countries, and that's important to keep in mind, as you say, Susan.
And another area you talked about how various different countries look at it differently is energy and the composition of how energy is made up. And I definitely want to get to that a little bit later on. But before I do, I mentioned there earlier about the impact of COVID and particularly government's responses by putting a lot of money into the economy in order to keep the show on the road. Now, many economists were worried that we would have massive inflation after the global financial crisis because governments were doing so much at the time to stimulate economies. And many of our listeners will remember that well. But that inflation didn't happen, Thomas. And I was struck by the differential that you pointed out in the book where you said in the US, fiscal support, which is money that the government put into the economy either through spending or lowering taxes, was worth 10% of GDP, but after COVID, it was 28% of GDP. Mm. So apart from the massive differential about the active role governments took in stabilising the economy, why is it that inflation happened massively after COVID, but not after the stimulus of the global financial crisis?
Yeah, that's also a very good question, Susan. I think it comes down to a couple of things, and I think we also talk about a bit about that in the book. First, the thing which happened in the global financial crisis was that you had real problems. You had an unbalanced economy. You had had overconsumption in US, in Europe. You had banks which had overlent. So when the crisis hit, there were real problems in the economy and in the financial system. And that, despite that you also have quite significant stimulus, both in, especially in US, but also to some extent in Europe, the consumers held back. And that was very different during COVID, because COVID was a health crisis, which then became a lockdown crisis and fortunately not a financial crisis. So when you opened up, actually, as long as people didn't fear too much to get sick, people and the financial system was willing to consume and lend. And that was a massive difference. And then the second thing I would say was that the stimulus was also even bigger in after COVID. So, for example, the numbers you are mentioning for the U.S. was simply enormous. And that is all the stimulus package in the U.S., which, of course, came through over time, but that amounted to something like 27-28% of GDP. And that was bigger than what you saw after the global financial crisis. So I would say it was a combination of the differences between the crisis, which was very, very different, and also the amount of stimulus. I would point to those two things.
And of course, you also elaborate a lot in the book about the fact that by the time we got to COVID, we had been through almost 15 years of deleveraging, of paying off debt, of where there was simply more money in households to go on and spend. Can you tell us about the money illusion you write about, where you say individuals tend to view their income and wealth in nominal terms as distinct to what they should be doing. What should our listeners be doing when it comes to looking at how wealthy they are?
Yeah, they should look at their real income, right? So they should always try to say, what do I get? And how do that compare to the inflation numbers I have? But people, or the inflation I'm seeing, but I think it's very natural that, so for example, when we look at housing prices also, we tend to look at it in nominal terms. And even if we get an interest rate, you know, we have an interest rate which has been very low, but inflation has also been very low. So in that sense, inflation in the what we call the real interest rate, the interest rate compared to inflation has not been as low. But people don't really 100% look only at, you can say in theory, they should look at the real stuff, the real wages, the real interest rate, so corrected for inflation. But I think they have many people have a bit of what we call money illusion, in the sense that they don't really completely regard the inflation as being part of the things they should look at. So they look at the nominal terms.
And of course, that's easy to do, because if I pick up my banking app and I look at it right now, I'll see the nominal number. I won't see, well, Susan, in a couple of years' time, here's what it'll actually be able to buy, which is the challenge of the money illusion. I was really taken by your point when it came to focusing on wage inflation in the book. You say, and I think this is so relevant for people today, you say the labour market is tighter than the unemployment figures suggest. Like,
and
I talk about things like full employment when we see unemployment getting to 4%, which we're now, for example, seeing in the US. And the ratio you look at is actually the comparison between job vacancies to the number of unemployed people.
Yeah.
When you do that, Thomas, what do you find?
So, and that's exactly the point. And I think what we misread a bit in the beginning after COVID, after the opening up, right? Because we saw an unemployment rate, which was not that low, right? It was compared to what we had seen before COVID, even sometime after COVID, after we had opened up. But the problem was that if we look at vacancies compared to the number of unemployed, the labor market, for example, in the US was extraordinarily tight. And actually also in my home country, Denmark, it was extraordinarily tight. So there was so much job demand, which is basically measured in vacancies. So that I think we misunderstood in the beginning, including myself. Then when I look at the situation now, it's much more balanced. And it's much more balanced both in the US and in Europe and in my home country, Denmark. So vacancies has come down compared to unemployed. So we are in a better position now, so to say. I think what has been interesting in this cycle is, and that is the same, especially in Europe and in my country, is that employment growth has continued. So we have continued to have very strong employment growth. But I think in many countries, you have actually had a lot of immigration, which has meant that despite that, there has been some demand still for labor. You had new people coming into the labor force, and therefore the labor market has not, employment growth has been high. But if we think as labor market tightness and being the demand versus supply, it has not been so tight because the supply has also come from foreigners. So that is also taking us some time to learn that also even where we are today.
Now, in Ireland, that is very much the case. What you're describing is that we are seeing a growing population and we are seeing a greater number of people in the labour market as a result. But I also want to ask you about labour force participation, because the way in which you analyse this geographically, there's lessons to learn as well in the book. So you said, in the UK, 363,000 people dropped out of the labour force around about COVID. You said in Asia, this is simply not a choice. And you picked up on this in China, in Japan, in India, in Indonesia, in South Korea. You really took a very granular approach to this. But then you spoke about Europe and you said the labour force participation actually increased because governments had a substantial focus on protecting employment. Now, let's bring it back home here again. Ireland, like I mentioned, has a growing population. So what's the link between the supply of people available to go to work and the wages they receive?
Yeah, so I think what you saw a bit in, for example, in the US, right, where you saw these quite, from a US standard, very extraordinary increase in unemployment benefits and stuff like that, which I think was maybe one of the reasons why it took some time for people to get back to the labor force. Also because some of them managed to actually, you can say they retired early and so forth. So I think there was a bit of that. I think what happened in the UK was simply it seemed that people simply were sick from related to COVID for some reason. Whereas I would say in Europe, so why was it different in Europe? I think it was because there was a lot of these wage compensation scheme. So for example, in Germany, you had this, what you call Kurzarbeit, where you try to basically continue to have, despite that people work less and they were not so attached to the labor market, you gave compensation to companies to continue to employ them. So you attach them still to the labor force, so to say. So there was this different, very big differences, both in labor force participation, which dropped quite a lot, for example, in the UK and the US, not really in Europe. And I think it's right, we make the comparison in Asia, that didn't happen because people could not afford it. And so there was clearly that difference. And that, of course, had a huge implications for labor market tightness, because I think one of the reasons why the labor market looked very tight in the US and to maybe a lesser extent in the UK was that a lot of people left the labor force for whatever reason. That was not really the case in continental Europe, and certainly not in my home country, Denmark, here.
And if we get to where the focus of the book really ties into, which is why did the inflation resurgence happen? And we focus very much now right at home. You summarize chapter 6, you say inflation in Europe was driven by high money supply, large fiscal support, a solid growth rebound. And you also highlight that it was driven primarily by exports in Europe as distinct to consumption in the US and rising energy prices. But over and over and over again, Thomas, you highlight that the invasion of Russia into the Ukraine has had a really big impact. And you quantify it in this way. You say Ukraine was one of the world's largest exporters of crops, grains and sunflower oil. And obviously the ability to produce and sell then was challenged, which led to food inflation. But also the EU imported 40% of its natural gas from Russia. And of course, then that was challenged. And this is where there's a very pithy number in here. You say the disruption to both directly accounted for half of euro inflation at the time. So could you elaborate a little bit on that and tell us, because this is what led to Irish people being going to the grocery shops or else looking at their electricity bills and saying, what has happened here?
Yeah. So you can say the calculation I do there, and you have read the book very carefully, Susan. That's great.
I have. It was worth it.
and that is exactly the same is the thing as saying, so you can say I make two assumptions. The first is that what we saw during that year was 100% driven by Ukraine or the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which of course may not be fully the case. But you can say that may overestimate the thing I'm saying coming from there. On the other hand, I only actually look at the direct impact, so food and energy prices. I actually don't look at how energy prices impact other prices. So I don't think it's a bad estimate. That's basically my conclusion, that it's a bit, you can say some may overestimate a bit, some may underestimate it a bit. But I think the message I'm trying to say is that I think the difference between US and Europe was huge, because I think US much less impacted by the Russian invasion by Ukraine, because they had a lot of the energy themselves, basically. And some is not traded on global markets. They had some gas themselves and so forth. And in the US, it was much more driven by simply strong demand. And that was some spillover to Europe, where Europe, you didn't have strong demand. And therefore, it was not because you had an economy which is booming, but there was just this massive energy and food price shock, which had a huge impact both directly on inflation and then indirectly on other goods. And, you know, if you go to the baker who needs to make his bread, of course, his energy price goes up, his energy costs go up. There must be some spillover into the bread he is selling. So I think that was, if you did not haven't had the Russian invasion of Ukraine, you would have had much lower inflation in Europe, maybe around, if I should put a number, maybe around 5%. Instead of, let's say, 11%.
And that, of course, would have made a massive difference at the time. Thomas, I would love to ask you lots more questions about the energy support packages from governments and how targeted they were. I'd love to ask you about the debate that you have your co-author in Chapter 7. And, of course, I'd love to ask you about the very title, which says What to Expect Next, but we're right up against the clock. So I'm going to leave it there. And thank you so much indeed, not just for joining me today, but for penning a really excellent book that's a most worthwhile read. Thanks so much, Thomas Haar, author of The Great Inflation Resurgence.
Thanks a lot, Susan.
Well, that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes-Cullerton. I hope you enjoy the show and possibly even learn something about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts, and make sure to subscribe to the show while you're there. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day. And I really look forward to chatting to you again next week.